great new Band-Aid headed off the major surgery. Expanded unemployment insurance, paid family leave, unions and new union alternatives, and so on, that an insecure citizenry so desperately needs. Hacker was referring back to groups of individually powerless citizens potentially banding together to gain strength in numbers and stand up to powerful interests. The idea, in short, of political action. That idea was now up against a far more seductive approach. The winners of the world deciding what and how much largesse to give, or concentrating on the Venn diagram overlap of solutions to underdogs' problems that also served them, and doing just enough of these things to keep at bay that very explosive impulse of banding together. If you ask the question, what is the best way to help Heather Jacobs? The honest answer probably wouldn't be to charge her $260 a year to smooth her income. If you were a person of education, privilege, and access to resources, as everyone at Even was, you might conclude that you should do something to repair the systems that are working to keep Jacobs poor. But if those problems were solved, you wouldn't have much of a win-win business to grow. If it became illegal to employ the Heather Jacobses of the world in the way that she was, or if Khosla's idea of massive redistribution were to be realized, Even might become unnecessary. Chapter 3. Rebel Kings in Worrisome Berets. One recent November, Stacy Asher and Greg Ferenstein and a few thousand other citizens of Market World found themselves aboard a 145,655 register-ton Norwegian cruise ship bound for the Bahamas. The idea of doing well for yourself by doing good for others is a gospel, one that is celebrated and re-evangelized at an unending chain of tent revivals around the world. The citizens of Market World can reinforce the mission at conference after conference. Davos, TED, Sun Valley, Aspen, Bilderberg, Dialogue, South by Southwest, Burning Man, TechCrunch Disrupt, the Consumer Electronics Show, and now at Summit at Sea, on a cruise ship full of entrepreneurs wishing to change the world. Summit at Sea was a four-day-long maritime bacchanal honoring the credo of using business to change the world, and perhaps of using changing the world to prosper in business. It brought together a great many entrepreneurs and financiers who invest in entrepreneurs, some artists and yoga teachers to keep things interesting and healthy, and various others who tend to run in those circles and whose bios refer to them using terms like influencer, thought leader, curator, convener, connector, and community manager. Summit, being one of the hotter Market World tickets, had drawn to this cruise ship the founders or representatives of such venerable institutions as AOL, Apple, the Bitcoin Foundation, Change.org, Dropbox, Google, Modernist Cuisine, MTV, PayPal, SoulCycle, Tom's Shoes, Uber, Vine, Virgin Galactic, Warby Parker, and Zappos. There were some billionaires and many millionaires on board, and lots of others who had paid a typical American's monthly salary to attend. Selena Su, a New York publicist who was on board and represented many of these entrepreneur types, perfectly captured the prevailing view. "I work with clients whose personal mission is to improve the lives of others," she writes on her website. "When their business grows, the world becomes a better place." Blair Miller, who was also on the ship and has long worked at what she sees as the nexus of business and social good, once put it this way in an interview published by a clothing boutique. "The question for me was never if I should devote my career to social impact. It was always, how can I make the most impact? Business is a dominant force in the world today, and I believe that if I can influence how business is done, I can change the lives of millions around the world." Once you believe that business is how you change things these days, a conference of entrepreneurs offers unlimited possibilities. Indeed, many boarding the ship had recently received an inspirational message from one of the conference's organizers that framed Summit's mission in world historical terms. "The winds are picking up in the east, and in 6 short days something transformational is going to be born from the sky and the moon, and it might just change history. We may not see the full effect now, but that's the case with any great shift in culture, any great seismic shift amongst the plates of planet Earth." A motivational speaker and thought leader named Sean Stevenson would offer a slightly more candid, if no less ambitious, account of Summit's purpose in a welcome speech to the attendees. It came in the form of three pointers for making the most of this chance. First, in this room, you can make contacts that will help you have cascading effects on humanity. Second, you're going to make friends who are going to impact your pocketbook. Third, the boat's not about getting drunk and getting naked. Well, it's sort of about that, but it's also about social justice. And yet the stubborn facts of an age of stark inequality clouded this vision of the pocketbook-impacting approach to social justice and the use of business to unlock potential and birth transformational things. The more these entrepreneurs waxed about changing the world, the more those facts got in their way, mocking their grandiose and self-serving claims. And this was most acutely true for a sub-tribe of the attendees of Summit at Sea, those hailing from Silicon Valley and the world of technology, with its audacious claims, even by market world standards, that what was good for business was great for mankind. The new barons of technology were the Rockefellers and Carnegies of our time, amassing giant fortunes, building the infrastructure of a new age, and often claiming to operate in the service of civilization itself. What's amazing about tech, Justin Rosenstein had said in light of his experiences at Google, Facebook, and his own startup to change the world, is that there are so many opportunities to have your cake and eat it too, right? Yet there was no denying that as they chewed away, these technologists were also partly responsible for prying inequality as unsustainably wide as it had gotten. It was no accident that the city they had adopted, San Francisco, had become perhaps the most cruelly unequal of American cities, with less and less space and chance for ordinary people to make a life. Many of them had clamored for the dismantling of systems designed, among other things, to protect equality, such as labor unions, zoning regulations, or the laws that assured job security and benefits for workers. How was the faith in the win-win maintained in the face of widespread evidence that one was in fact contributing to inequality? How did these new barons relieve the cognitive dissonance they might have felt from claiming to improve others' lives while noticing that their own were perhaps the only ones getting better? One day at Summit at Sea, in the well of the Bliss Ultra Lounge, on the seventh floor of the ship, a high priest of this technology world, a venture capitalist named Shervin Peshaver, was demonstrating one form of relief. Peshaver was among the leading venture capitalists in the Valley, a status he had cemented by placing early bets on Airbnb and Uber. Those investments earned the kind of returns that could allow one's grandchildren to be full-time philanthropists. Peshaver was an Iranian-born immigrant whose adopted country, through its Department of Homeland Security, had named him an outstanding American by choice. He was a kingmaker in the Valley, whom the founder of Uber, Travis Kalanick, had reportedly leaned on as a tutor in the art of going clubbing in Los Angeles, with Peshaver providing club clothes, according to the New York Times. And the entrepreneurs at Summit at Sea knew that a VC like Peshaver, whose firm was called Sherpa Ventures, was in a position, should he so choose, to guide any of them to the mountaintop. This knowledge helped explain the crush of bodies that had come to see Peshaver's talk, titled All Aboard the Hyperloop, Supersonic Storytelling with VC Shervin Peshaver. People were curled up on armchairs and sofas. Some sat and others lay down on the ground. Still others hovered above, ringed a few deep around a balcony on the eighth floor, peering down. The crowd was listening in rapt, reverent silence. What they heard was a powerful man who seemed at pains to explain his power away, and to cast himself as a man in pursuit of things nobler than money. "Sharing is caring," Peshaver said at one point. He admitted it was corny, but he said he truly believed it. "At the end of the day, it's not about the money," he continued. "It's about the love and those moments of character." The summit people clapped hard and whooped in recognition. They believed it wasn't about the money for them either, one would guess. Peshaver turned to the topic of life-extending technology, which is a major focus of his work now. He was hardly the only Valley man pursuing the elongation of the lives of people who presumably could pay. "The next 20-30 years, my best piece of advice is stay alive," Peshaver said. "Don't take really stupid risks." This clashed with his business mantra of taking as many risks as possible. "Physically, I'm saying. And get ready, because the things that are coming down the pipe in terms of genetic research, our lifespans and the health of our lives are going to be longer, and it's going to challenge the very basis of our current civilization. The way things are structured today are not going to be relevant to what the reality is going to be of people who are going to have so much knowledge and living so long and healthier lives. The idea of retiring at 70 is going to seem like people telling you at 30 to retire. Here Peshaver was engaging in advocacy that disguised itself as prophecy, which was common among technology barons, and one of the ways in which they masked the fact of their power in an age rattled by the growing anxieties of the powerless. VCs and entrepreneurs are considered by many to be thinkers these days, their commercial utterances treated like ideas, and these ideas are often in the future tense, claims about the next world forged by adding up the theses of their portfolio companies or extrapolating from their own startup's mission statement. That people listened to their ideas gave them a chance to launder their self-interested hopes into more selfless-sounding predictions about the world. For example, a baron wishing to withhold benefits from workers might reframe that desire as a prediction about a future in which every human being is a solo entrepreneur. A social media billionaire, keen to profit from the higher advertising revenue that video posts draw, compared to text ones, might recast that interest, and his rewriting of the powerful algorithms he owns to get what he wants, as a prediction that, I just think that we're going to be in a world a few years from now where the vast majority of the content that people consume online will be video. New York Magazine had skewered Mark Zuckerberg after he issued that prediction at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. The vast majority of web content will be video, says man who can unilaterally make such a decision. In the Valley, prediction has become a popular way of fighting for a particular future, while claiming merely to be describing what has yet to occur. Prediction has a useful air of selflessness to it. Predictors aren't caught in the here and now of their own appetites and interests. It seems like they aren't choosing how things will be in the future any more than they choose the color of their eyes. Yet selecting one scenario among many possible scenarios, and persuading everybody of its inevitability, and of the futility of a society's exercising its collective choice among these futures, is a deft way to shape the future. As he predicted the elongation of life, and other such things that are coming down the pipe, Peshaver was in fact pushing those things down the pipe. He was part of a group of elites who had been very smart, and very lucky with startup investments, and who now got to make decisions of enormous social consequence about what to do about the human lifespan. This power gave them great responsibility and exposed them to the possibility of resentment, unless they convinced people that the future they were fighting for would unfold automatically, would be the fruit of forces rather than their choices, of providence rather than power. Hence the cleverness of Peshaver's passive framing of his own goals. The way things are structured today are not going to be relevant to what the reality is going to be. Longer lives for rich people were just something that happened to be coming down the pipe, not so much a better healthcare system for all. What are the characteristics of people who are able to do world-changing ideas? Someone in the crowd asked during the Q&A portion. This question set Peshaver up well to present himself and his fellow elites as rebels up against the powerful, and not as power itself. The characteristic that world changers have in common, Peshaver said, is a willingness to fight for the truth. It had nothing to do with their being more luckily born than you, unburdened by racial and gender discrimination, and with greater access to seed capital from family and friends. It was that they were braver, bolder than you. Some might say ruthless, willing to take on power, no matter the cost. Citing Travis Kalanick of Uber and Elon Musk of Tesla, he said, "They are most comfortable in the uncomfortable places. What that means is they're very comfortable having uncomfortable conversations. And most of us want to just be kumbaya, everything's great, I'm happy, you're happy, we're good, besties, BFFs. And it's like, no, fuck that. Let's challenge each other. What's going on here? What is the truth?" When things get uncomfortable, the reason it's getting uncomfortable is because there's a conflict between something that's true and something that's not true. And the only way to suss that out, figure it out, is to poke at it. And people like that who make big ideas happen don't run away from those conflicts. They actually embrace it. This idea of the startup pursuing its singular truth in this fashion was part of Peshaver's rebellious self-conception. A king presides over a multitude of truths, but a rebel who takes no responsibility for the whole, is free to pursue his singular truth. That is the whole point of being a rebel. It is not in the rebel's job description to worry about others who might have needs that are different from his. By Peshaver's lights, when a company like Uber challenged regulators and unions, there were not rival interests at play, so much as a singular truth vying with opposition, and insurgent rebels going up against a corrupt establishment. This became even clearer with his answer to the following question. How do you find the balance between morality and ambition and having to compete? Because Peshaver did not think himself powerful, because he refused to see the companies he invested in as powerful, he seemed not to understand the question. It takes a certain acceptance of one's own power to see oneself as facing moral choices. If instead what you see in the mirror is a rebel outgunned by the man, besieged, fighting for your life, you might be tempted to misinterpret the question in the way that Peshaver now did. He interpreted it as being about how he, a moral man, representing a moral company, again he chose the example of Uber, stood up against immoral forces. My biggest thing is existing structures and monopolies. One example is the taxi cartels. That is a very real thing, he said. I've been in meetings where I've been threatened by those types of characters from that world. I've seen them beating drivers in Italy. You see the riots in France and flipping over cars and throwing stones. I took my daughter to Disney. We were in the middle of that. We had to drive our Uber away from basically the war zone that was happening. So from a moral perspective, anything that's fighting against morally corrupt, ingrained systems that are based on decades and decades of graft within cities, within city councils, with mayors, etc., all those things, they are real, actual things that are threatened by new technologies and innovations like Uber and other companies in that space. So from that perspective, bring it on. That is something we should be fighting. And from a moral perspective, we have a responsibility to fight those types of pockets of control. And they exist at all levels, in the city level to the state and even at the national and global. Peshaver was not only casting venture capitalists and billionaire company founders as rebels against the establishment, fighting the powers that be on behalf of ordinary people. He was also maligning the very institutions that are meant to care for ordinary people and promote equality. He referred to unions as cartels. He cast protests, which were a fairly standard feature of labor movements, as a war zone. He spoke of taxi drivers and their representatives in the language of the corrupt mafioso other. Those types of characters from that world. Here was a leading investor in a company, Uber, that had sought to shatter democratically enacted regulations and evade the unions that have a record of actually, and not just rhetorically, fighting for the little guy. And he was proudly portraying himself as the one who was truly fighting for the people against the corrupt power structure. In the era when political power corrupts, social and crowdsourced power cleanses, Peshaver once wrote. We must stir the hornet's nest to build immunity to the sting of corruption. Speaking of the regulations he didn't like, and unions he didn't like, Peshaver said, finding companies that can disrupt those is one way of having some kind of ethical philosophy of saying, we are going to use our capacity and our knowledge to improve our world by getting rid of some of those points of control. In short, technological disruption was the venture capitalist's way of making the world a better place for everyone's benefit. Applause and whoops. Peshaver spoke as an insurgent, with none of the grace and sense of obligation of the man who accepts his own arrival. Nor did his bearing suggest any awareness that Uber and Airbnb, of which he loved to speak, now faced serious charges of exploitative and illegal behavior toward people who genuinely lacked power. In Peshaver's mind, he and those companies were the weak ones. There he was, driving in Paris, with protesting drivers creating a war zone and threatening him and his child. There he was, trying to cleanse corruption by defying local city regulations. There he was, clinging to his unpopular truth like Martin Luther reincarnated as a VC, nailing feces to the doors at the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission. VCs are among the most powerful people in the world today. But in his mind, he was the little guy. When your leader still wears the beret from his days in the rebel army, you should be afraid. As the Q&A ended, Peshaver praised the summit conference as a movement of value creation, seamlessly merging the language of Selma and Harvard Business School. To take the edge off of value creation, a phrase that risked reminding people that he was a powerful gazillionaire, he once again invoked mushy language. Value creation, he said, was brought into one's life by value creators, people who put you in an environment of love, faith, support. Here he was appropriating a language of movements and love, solidarity and selflessness, and even the therapeutic language of sharing being caring, and using it to dress up the naked truth of his oligarchic visions. He had the audacity to board an expensive, exclusive, invitation-only cruise ship conference full of entrepreneurs, and yet claim it was taxi drivers who constituted the unjust cartel. He could profit from and defend a company doing everything in its power to smash the idea of a labor movement, while unabashedly speaking of this conference in the language of movements. He could, as a Silicon Valley venture capitalist, be the very picture of what was making the country less equal, while claiming to be fighting on behalf of the common man. Shervin Peshaver's refusal to own up to his power was not an isolated occurrence. Such modesty is a defining feature of Silicon Valley, an epicenter of new power. They fight as though they are insurgents, while they operate as though they are kings, writes Dana Boyd, a technology scholar. She came of age among hackers and renegades, and then grew frustrated with their failure to accept victory. They now owned the tools of modern power, but the group's self-image as outsiders, a hangover from the sector's countercultural origins, left it ill-equipped to understand its own actions and practices as part of the elite, the powerful, Boyd argues. And powerful people who see themselves as underdogs in a world where instability and inequality are rampant fail to realize that they have a moral responsibility. As it happens, the two companies that had made Peshaver a legend got into legal trouble for engaging in that very sort of denialism. Airbnb's troubles began some months before Summit at Sea, when an African-American woman named Cortina Crittenden took to Twitter to complain of being racially profiled when trying to book accommodations, posting screenshots of rejections by hosts whose rentals had been listed as available for a given date range. Crittenden added the tag Airbnb while black. Over time, others began to add their testimonies to Crittenden's, especially after she was profiled by National Public Radio the following year. The stories began to fly. One bachelor's degree, one master's degree, and one doctorate's degree later, and I still can't rent your apartment. SMH, hashtag Airbnb while black. Then a black user named Gregory Selden shared a story of how he had made a fake profile as a white guy and was accepted immediately. Selden's tweet went viral, and a social media firestorm was born. Because of how Airbnb and other Silicon Valley platforms work, the company faced a choice of how to respond. Airbnb could claim that the platform itself has little power, that it cannot be held responsible for what occurs between two autonomous people on its site. But it surprised many by putting out a report some months later in which it committed to make powerful systemic changes to greatly reduce the opportunity for hosts and guests to engage in conscious or unconscious discriminatory conduct. These steps were admirable and also voluntary. 2 months after the viral explosion of hashtag Airbnb while black, however, when the company received complaints from California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing alleging that it may have failed to prevent discrimination against African-American guests and may have engaged in acts of discrimination itself, Airbnb retreated. While Airbnb simply operates a platform and is not well positioned to make determinations regarding the booking decisions hosts make in each case, the company said in a legal response, Airbnb has recognized on its own, based on available data, that some third-party hosts on its site are likely violating Airbnb's policy against racial discrimination, and that its policies and processes have to date been insufficient fully to address the problem. Yet, despite a Harvard Business School study that backed up users' claims of discrimination, the company said it was merely engaged in the publication of rental listings, a humble role that it said immunizes it against liability. Airbnb, it argued, cannot be held legally liable for the conduct of its third-party users. The law, the company said, does not impose a duty to prevent discrimination by others. At the time hashtag Airbnb while black launched, Shervin Peshaver's other star investment, Uber, was embroiled in its own case about whether it was as humble and powerless as it claimed. A group of drivers had sued Uber, as well as its rival Lyft, in federal court, seeking to be treated as employees under California's labor laws. Their case was weakened by the fact that they had signed agreements to be contractors not subject to those laws. They had accepted the terms and conditions that cast each driver as an entrepreneur, a free agent choosing her hours, needing none of the regulatory infrastructure that others depended on. They had bought into one of the reigning fantasies of Market World, that people were their own miniature corporations. Then some of the drivers realized that in fact they were simply working people who wanted the same protections that so many others did, from power, exploitation, and the vicissitudes of circumstance. Because the drivers had signed that agreement, they had blocked the easy path to being employees. But under the law, if they could prove that a company had pervasive, ongoing power over them as they did their work, they could still qualify as employees. To be a contractor is to give up certain protections and benefits in exchange for independence, and thus that independence must be genuine. The case inspired the judges in the two cases, Edward Chen and Vince Chabria, to grapple thoughtfully with the question of where power lurks in a new networked age. It was no surprise that Uber and Lyft took the rebel position. Like Airbnb, Uber and Lyft claimed not to be powerful. Uber argued that it was just a technology firm facilitating links between passengers and drivers, not a car service. The drivers who had signed contracts were robust agents of their own destiny. Judge Chen derided this argument. Uber is no more a technology company, he wrote, than Yellow Cab is a technology company because it uses CB radios to dispatch taxicabs. John Deere is a technology company because it uses computers and robots to manufacture lawnmowers. Or Domino Sugar is a technology company because it uses modern irrigation techniques to grow its sugarcane. Judge Chabria similarly cited and tore down Lyft's claim to be an uninterested bystander of sorts, merely furnishing a platform that allows drivers and riders to connect. He wrote, "Lyft concerns itself with far more than simply connecting random users of its platform. It markets itself to customers as an on-demand ride service, and it actively seeks out those customers. It gives drivers detailed instructions about how to conduct themselves. Notably, Lyft's own driver's guide and FAQs state that drivers are driving for Lyft. Therefore, the argument that Lyft is merely a platform and that drivers perform no service for Lyft is not a serious one." The judges believed Uber and Lyft to be more powerful than they were willing to admit. But they also conceded that the companies did not have the same power over employees as an old economy employer like Walmart. The jury in this case will be handed a square peg and asked to choose between two round holes, Judge Chabria wrote. Judge Chen, meanwhile, wondered whether Uber, despite a claim of impotence at the center of the network, exerted a kind of invisible power over drivers that might give them a case. In order to define this new power, he decided to turn where few judges do, the late French philosopher Michel Foucault. In a remarkable passage, Judge Chen compared Uber's power to that of the guards at the center of the Panopticon, which Foucault famously analyzed in Discipline and Punish. The Panopticon was a design for a circular prison building dreamed up in the 18th century by the philosopher Jeremy Bentham. The idea was to empower a solitary guard in the center of the building to watch over a large number of inmates, not because he was actually able to see them all at once, but because the design kept any prisoner from knowing who was being observed at any given moment. Foucault analyzed the nature and working of power in the Panopticon, and the judge found it analogous to Uber's. He quoted a line about the state of conscious and permanent visibility that assures the automatic functioning of power. The judge was suggesting that the various ways in which Uber monitored, tracked, controlled, and gave feedback on the service of its drivers amounted to the functioning of power, even if the familiar trappings of power, ownership of assets, control over an employee's time, were missing. The drivers weren't like factory workers employed and regimented by a plant, yet they weren't independent contractors who could do whatever they pleased. They could be fired for small infractions. That is power. It can be disturbing that the most influential emerging power center of our age is in the habit of denying its power, and therefore of promoting a vision of change that changes nothing meaningful while enriching itself. Its posture is not entirely cynical, though. The technology world has long maintained that the tools it creates are inherently leveling and will serve to collapse power divides rather than widen them. In the mid-1990s, as the Internet began reaching into people's lives, Bill Gates predicted that technology would help to equalize a stubbornly unequal world. We are all created equal in the virtual world, and we can use this equality to help address some of the sociological problems that society has yet to solve in the physical world. The network will not eliminate barriers of prejudice or inequality, but it will be a powerful force in that direction. It is hard to overstate how influential this belief has become in market world, especially in Silicon Valley. The world may be cruel and unfair, but if you sprinkle seeds of technology on it, shoots of equality will sprout. If every girl in Afghanistan had a smartphone, if every classroom were linked to the web, if every police officer wore a body camera, Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan have vowed to connect the unconnected as part of their philanthropic work, because the internet provides education if you don't live near a good school. It provides health information on how to avoid diseases or raise healthy children if you don't live near a doctor. It provides financial services if you don't live near a bank. It provides access to jobs and opportunities if you don't live in a good economy. Some in the Valley have become downright glib about the leveling bias of technology. Thanks to Airbnb, the venture capitalist Mark Andreessen says, now anyone with a house or apartment can offer a room for rent. Hence, income inequality reduced. Investors like Andreessen, according to this view, are just like the Occupy movement, but with bigger houses and clearer results. Networks are the basis for much of this new power. Networks that simultaneously push power out to the edges and suck it into the core. This idea comes from an authority on networks, Joshua Cooper Ramo, a journalist turned protege of Henry Kissinger, who some years ago became interested in how new varieties of power were upending the old laws of strategy and geopolitics. His study of networks and interviews with their owners became a book, The Seventh Sense, in which he says that this new power is defined by both profound concentration and by massive distribution. It can't be understood in simple either-or terms. Power and influence may yet become even more centralized than it was in feudal times, and more distributed than it was in the most vibrant democracies. Ramo is arguing that the Ubers and Airbnbs and Facebooks and Googles of the world are at once radically democratic and dangerously oligarchic. Facebook emancipates people in Algerian basements to write whatever they want for all the world to see. Airbnb allows anyone to rent out their home. Uber allows anyone going through financial hardship to download the app and without much hassle get started making money. These platforms are pushing power out to the edges, power once controlled by media companies, hotel chains, and taxi unions. But networks tend toward extreme concentration as well. It is no fun if half of your high school friends are on the other social network, so Facebook becomes a de facto monopoly. A core tenet of network theory is that the bigger the network, the more juice it will be able to squeeze from every new connection. Networks, then, are those rare beasts that get healthier, tougher, and faster the fatter they become. This simultaneous concentrating and diffusing of power has real consequences for the distribution of societal power. Tech people like to picture their industry as a roiling sea of disruption in which every winner is vulnerable to surprise attack from some novel as yet unimagined foe, writes Farhad Manju, who covers the sector for the New York Times. In fact, he notes, the industry is more concentrated than most, with Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft controlling much of everything. By almost any measure, the frightful five, as Manju calls them, are getting larger, more entrenched in their own sectors, more powerful in new sectors, and better insulated against surprising competition from upstarts. If technology keeps spawning Goliaths, it is because of the concentrating pressure of networks that Ramo described. Those players have built certain foundational networks, often called platforms, that upstarts have ever less of a choice but to build on the bigger those networks get. These platforms, Manju writes, are inescapable. You may opt out of one or two of them, but together they form a gilded mesh, blanketing the entire economy. Facebook, despite calling itself a community, single-handedly redefined the word friend for much of humanity, based on what was best for its own business model. Another company, Google, can know everything you search for and buy, every off-color joke you have ever typed, every utterance you have spoken in your home in the presence of its kitchen helper, every move you've made in front of its home security camera. Airbnb boasted of 1.3 million people staying in one of its properties on a single New Year's Eve. As technologies like these have eaten the world, a relatively small number of people have come to own much of the infrastructure on which ever more human discourse, motion, buying, selling, reading, writing, teaching, learning, healing, and trading are done or arranged, even as many of them make public pronouncements about fighting against the establishment. David Heinemeier Hansen is the co-founder of a Colorado-based software company called Basecamp, a successful but modest business that stayed relatively small and avoided the lure of Silicon Valley and of trying to swallow the world. Part of the problem seems to be that nobody these days is content to put their dent in the universe, he has written. No, they have to fucking own the universe. It's not enough to be in the market, they have to dominate it. It's not enough to serve customers, they have to capture them. Maciej Segwalski, the founder of a startup called Pinboard, made waves in the Valley and beyond when he gave a talk comparing VCs first to the landed lords of feudal England, then to the central planners who once ran his native Poland. There's something very fishy about California capitalism. Investing has become the genteel occupation of our gentry, like having a country estate used to be in England. It's a class marker and a socially acceptable way for rich techies to pass their time. Gentlemen investors decide what ideas are worth pursuing, and the people pitching to them tailor their proposals accordingly. The companies that come out of this are no longer pursuing profit or even revenue. Instead, the measure of their success is valuation, how much money they've convinced people to tell them they're worth. There's an element of fantasy to the whole enterprise that even the tech elite is starting to find unsettling. We had people like this back in Poland, except instead of venture capitalists, we called them central planners. They too were in charge of allocating vast amounts of money that didn't belong to them. They too honestly believed they were changing the world and offered the same kinds of excuses about why our day-to-day life bore no relation to the shiny, beautiful world that was supposed to lie just around the corner. Over a generation, America has grappled with one problem after another that could be said to have contributed to the decay of its politics and many people's livelihoods. The American social contract has frayed, and workers' lives have grown more precarious, and mobility has slowed. These are hard and important problems. The new winners of the age might well have participated in the writing of a new social contract for a new age, a new vision of economic security for ordinary people in a globalized and digitized world. But as we've seen, they actually made the situation worse by seeking to bust unions and whatever other worker protections still lingered, and to remake more and more of the society as an always-on labor market in which workers were downbidding one another for millions of little fleeting gigs. Any industry that still has unions has potential energy that could be released by startups, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist Paul Graham once tweeted. As America's level of inequality spread to ever more unmanageable levels, these market world winners might have helped out. Looking within their own communities would have told them what they needed to know. Doing everything to reduce their tax burdens, even when legal, stands in contradiction with their claims to do well by doing good. Diverting the public's attention from an issue like offshore banking worsens the big problems, even as these market worlders shower attention on niche causes. As life expectancy declined among large subpopulations of Americans, winners possessed of a sense of having arrived might have chipped in. They might have taken an interest in the details of a healthcare system that was allowing the unusual phenomenon of a developed country regressing in this way, or in the persistence of easily preventable deaths in the developing world. They might not have thought of themselves at all, given how long they were likely to live because of their tremendous advantages. It seems pretty egocentric while we still have malaria and TB for rich people to fund things so they can live longer, Bill Gates has said. Perhaps the most unlikely featured speaker at Summit at Sea was Edward Snowden, American whistleblower, scourge of the National Security Agency. He was in Russia, coming to the ship via video. His interviewer was Chris Sacca, a wildly successful VC. Instagram, Kickstarter, Twitter, Uber. One of the founders of Summit walked on stage and said, "We need truth-tellers and thought-leaders like Chris Sacca." Two truth-tellers for the price of one. Sacca, taking the stage, praised Summit for becoming what he called a platform for entrepreneurship, for justice. He said it as if the two were the same. Then he interviewed Snowden for a time, eliciting what had become his whistleblower stump speech. At one point, the man in Moscow began to say what would quicken the heart of any chaser of valley glory. The world's most famous leaker spoke of the need to build new communication tools that went beyond encryption to be entirely untraceable, so that even the fact of a conversation having occurred between two people would remain unknown. He talked about tokenizing identity, giving people ways of participating in the online communities of the age without becoming vulnerable to being followed from platform to platform and having people know every book they had read, every movement they had participated in, every friend they had made. When we think about the civil rights movement, Snowden said, when we think about every social progress that's happened throughout history, going all the way back to the Renaissance, going back to people thinking about heretical ideas, hey, maybe the world is not flat. Even making these arguments, challenging conventions, challenging the structures of law on any given day, itself is a violation of law. And if the minute somebody starts engaging in heretical thinking, the minute somebody breaks a law, even if it's a simple minor regulation, if that can be instantly detected, interdicted, and then remediated through some kind of penalty or sanction, not only would we never see startups like Uber get off the ground, but it will freeze human social progress in place. Because you'll no longer have the chance to challenge orthodoxies without being immediately singled out, thrown off in the pen, having no possibility or capability to build a critical mass that could lead to change. Perhaps in an effort to be courteous to his entrepreneurial audience, Snowden had tucked a mention of a startup into his much grander vision of heresy, thereby destroying whatever chance he had for his ideas to be heard as they were intended. He had ensured that Saka, and presumably many others, would now hear his revolutionary words and think only of investment. "So I invest in founders for a living," Saka said, staring up at the giant screen. "And I gotta tell you, as I listen to you, I smell a founder here. You're talking about these things that need to be built. Are you gonna build any of them? Because there's probably investors waiting for you here." Snowden seemed taken aback. Here he was talking about heresy and truth and freedom, and now he was being asked about a startup. Flummoxed, he tried to let Saka down politely. "I do have a number of projects that are actively in motion, but I take a little bit of a different view from a lot of people who need venture capital, who are trying to get investors. I don't like to promote things. I don't like to say I'm working on this particular system to solve this particular problem. I would rather simply do it at the minimum expenditure of resources and then be judged on the basis of results. If it works, if it expands, that's wonderful. But ultimately for me, I don't tend to think that I'm going to be working in a commercial space. So I would rather say, let's wait and see." It was a kindly delivered rebuke to market world's way of life. Here was a man who didn't like to promote himself, who didn't crave money, who was actually fighting the system and willing to lose for the greater good to win. At Summit, Snowden called for one spot, anywhere in the world where we can experiment, where we can be safe. For him, this was a serious vision, perhaps involving life and death. Entrepreneurs, as if to mimic genuine renegades, tended to invoke the same idea, but in their case it was less about challenging power than about amassing and protecting it. The entrepreneur and investor Peter Thiel called for floating, seasteading communities far from the reach of law. Larry Page, the co-founder of Google, reportedly said, "As technologists, we should have some safe places where we can try out new things and figure out the effect on society." The technology investor Balaji Srinivasan called for the winners of the digital revolution to secede from the ungrateful world of Luddites and complainers. Silicon Valley's ultimate exit, as he put it, using tools like those Snowden had imagined, to build an opt-in society ultimately outside the United States, run by technology. What connects these various notions is a fantasy of living free of government. These rich and powerful men engage in what the writer Kevin Roos has called anarchist cheerleading, in keeping with their carefully crafted image as rebels against the authorities. To call for a terrain without rules in the way they do, to dabble in this anarchist cheerleading, maybe to sound like you wished for a new world of freedom on behalf of humankind. But a long line of thinkers has told us that the powerful tend to be the big winners from the creation of blank slate, rules-free worlds. A famous statement of that finding came from the feminist writer Jo Freeman, who in her 1972 essay, The Tyranny of Structurelessness, observed that when groups operate on vague or anarchic terms, structurelessness becomes a smokescreen for the strong or the lucky to establish unquestioned hegemony over others. Freeman's idea could be traced back to the Enlightenment and Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes also believed that structurelessness wasn't all it was cracked up to be, especially for the weak. The powerful Leviathan for which he advocated is often treated as shorthand for monarchy or authoritarianism. But in fact, what Hobbes suggested was that the choice is not between authority and liberty, but between authority of one sort and authority of another. Someone always rules. The question is who. In a world without a Leviathan, which is to say a strong state capable of making and enforcing universal rules, people will be ruled by thousands of miniature Leviathans closer to home, by the feudal lords on whose soil they work and against whom they have few defenses, by powerful, whimsical, unaccountable princes. Hobbes articulated a vision of an authority in which everyone had a formal legal investment, an authority that belonged to us in common and that trumped local authorities. He believed that there could be greater liberty under such an authority than in its absence. Men have no pleasure, but on the contrary a great deal of grief, in keeping company where there is no power able to overawe them all. In a world without rules, he wrote, nothing can be unjust. The notions of right and wrong, justice and injustice, have there no place. Where there is no common power, there is no law. Where no law, no injustice. The cardinal virtues in such a world are force and fraud. The self-styled entrepreneur rebels were actually seeking to overturn a major project of the Enlightenment, the development of universal rules that applied evenly to all, freeing people from the particularisms of their villages, churches, and domains. The world that these elites seemed to envision, in which rules receded and entrepreneurs reigned through the market, augured a return to private manners, allowing the Earl of Facebook and the Lord of Google to make major decisions about our shared fate outside of democracy. It would be a world that let them deny their power over the serfs around them by appropriating a language of community and love, movements and win-wins. They would keep on speaking of changing the world, but many, down in the world, would feel, not without reason, that what was bleak in the world somehow wasn't changing. It is not inevitable that what passes for progress in our age involves the concentration of power into a small number of hands and the issuance of stories about the powerful being fighters for the little guy. There are people thinking about other, more honest ways of making the world a better place, and thinking freely without the burdensome market world requirement that progress must tend to the winners and obey their rules. But it is not easy to compete with market world for the resources and branding power it is able to throw at its works. A few months after Summit, an event at the Goethe Institute in New York offered a very different vision for the digital age. It was a meeting of a budding movement called Platform Cooperativism. Here was a conversation about making the world better that eschewed the win-win commandment that the powerful should benefit from any change for that change to be worth doing. Platform cooperativism is a movement that seeks to make true what Silicon Valley claims is already occurring, proposing a new kind of online economy, as one of its digital pamphlets put it. For all the wonders the internet brings us, it is dominated by an economics of monopoly, extraction, and surveillance. Ordinary users retain little control over their personal data, and the digital workplace is creeping into every corner of workers' lives. Online platforms often exploit and exacerbate existing inequalities in society, even while promising to be the great equalizers. Could the internet be owned and governed differently? To talk like this was to flirt with the actual and not rhetorical changing of the world. One did not regularly encounter ideas like this in market world, even though the suppositions behind them were obvious, that sometimes the builders of technology serve only themselves, that sometimes humanitarianism and entrepreneurship are actually distinct things. The subversive premise of platform co-op, as the cause was casually known, ought not to have been as subversive as it was. That ordinary people, and not just the winners of market world, should have some say in how technology develops. That it could develop in more than one direction. That some of those directions would be better than others at turning innovation into progress for most people. One heard from speakers ways of thinking that were all but barred from market world. The idea that there were such things as power and privilege, that some people had them in every era and some people didn't, that this power and privilege demanded wariness, that progress was not inevitable, and that history was not a line but a wheel, that sometimes astonishing new tools were used in ways that worsened the world, that places of darkness often persisted even under new light, that people had a long habit of exploiting one another, no matter how selfless they and their ideas seem, that the powerful are your equals as citizens, not your representatives. The attendees didn't confine their speech to win-wins. They spoke of exploitation and abuse and solidarity. They spoke of problems. They were not bound by the genteel market world consensus. The audience was cynical rather than utopian, critical rather than boosting. They knew what wasn't new. The speakers, for their part, had none of market world's customary slickness. Presentations weren't smooth. No lavalier microphones were on offer. No one roamed the stage like a lion on the savannah. There were few, if any, jokes in the talks. People just spoke to the problems they wished to solve. The event was a thrillingly democratic contrast with Summit at Sea and other market world forums. Trevor Schultz stepped up to the podium and explained why, a few years earlier, he had written a short essay on an idea that he coined as platform cooperativism. As he surveyed the world being remade by Silicon Valley, and especially what was once called the sharing economy, he began to see through the fantasy speak. Here were a handful of companies thriving by serving as middlemen between people who wanted rides and people who offered them, people who wanted their IKEA furniture assembled and people who came over to install it, people who defrayed their costs by renting out a room and people who stayed there. It was no accident, Schultz believed, that these services had taken off at the historical moment that they had. An epic meltdown of the world financial system had cost millions of people their homes, jobs, and health insurance. And as the fallout from the crash spread, many of those cut loose had been drafted into joining a new American servant class. The precariousness at the bottom, which had shown few signs of improving several years after the meltdown, had become the fodder for a bounty of services for the affluent, and, Schultz noted, for the channeling of wealth in fewer and fewer hands. Somehow, the technology celebrated by the Valley as leveling playing fields and emancipating people had fostered a slick new, digitally enabled, upstairs-downstairs line in American social life. It didn't have to be this way, said Schultz. Technology was neither inherently feudal nor inherently democratic. It had, as Ramo wrote, both tendencies. Which tendency would win out depended on the values of the age and what people chose to fight for. We live in an era in which it is remarkably easy, by historical standards, to build a platform like Uber or Airbnb. Yet for all this ease, the big platforms tend to be owned by small cliques of investors like Shervin Peshaver and Chris Sacca, run for their benefit and given to extracting as much value from workers as they can at very low prices. If it is so easy to build platforms these days, Schultz wondered, why couldn't workers and customers create their own platforms? Schultz had embarked on a global adventure to locate and study various attempts to do just this. The idea lived already in many little embryos. There was Fairmondo and Lokonomics and Members Media and various others. But it wasn't just about these companies, Schultz said. I'm not really talking about an app. I'm not really talking about technology per se. But it is really about the change of a mindset that is now based on this kind of extractive economy, but is working towards one that is really based on mutualism and cooperativism. Here was a rarity, a no-strings-attached idea for actually changing the world. When Schultz spoke at events, he was asked over and over how democratically owned tools could ever compete with powerful corporate platforms. How can we achieve scale, people would ask. How can we reach out to the masses? We are the masses, Schultz reminded them. He ceded the floor to people working on various aspects of platform co-op. Brendan Martin was the founder of The Working World, a cooperative financial institution active in Argentina, Nicaragua, and the United States. He was seeking to build what he called non-extractive finance. He told the audience that the challenge represented by platform co-op was part of a very old human story. The fight over platforms, whether they are cooperative or owned by just a few, you can look and you can distill history down to essentially being that fight. Class warfare can really be about who gets to own it, a couple of us or all of us. It is things that have public benefit that are owned by a couple of people, and they get to extract what they will from those who have to use it, or they are shared for the collective benefit. What is new about technology here? It's just a new space to have that battle in. Who owns what no one has any choice but to use? it is an ancient question that has become central to a new age. Martin looked at the new platforms and saw links to earlier platforms, the platforms of granaries, of gold, of land. Revolution after revolution over the ages had called for the cancellation of debts and the redistribution of land. "We might change that now to cancel the debts and redistribute the platform," Martin said. Then there was Emma Yora, who co-directed the cooperative development program at the Center for Family Life in Brooklyn. She was running a social service program that had little apparent connection to technology. The center had, some years earlier, begun to organize worker cooperatives to help poor immigrants locate work in house cleaning, child care, pet care, and the like, and to keep as much of the pay as possible, rather than forking it over to a middleman. One day, Yora was taking the subway, and she saw an ad that angered her. It was for one of the slick new digital platforms offering super easy house cleaning. As she recalled it, "It's an ad that's really promoting itself for its technological ease of use. I think it's like, get a clean apartment with one click. And it's just got this hand that is a yellow-gloved hand. It's kind of disembodied, and it's got a sponge, and you're going to get this clean apartment cleaned by someone you don't see, some magical elf who has a yellow hand. And it's not really a person, right? It's all about the technology." This was what had bothered Yora. The technology, which had made the service easier to procure, had also changed the nature of the interaction. The one-click app obscured the messy human reality of the working people behind it, who now had less bargaining power. Yora had begun to build what she imagined as a cooperative answer to the one-click cleaning service. Because market world is so hard to escape even when you are rejecting it, she had taken funding from the Robin Hood Foundation, financed by the titans of Wall Street, to build her service. The effort was still in progress that night at the Goethe Institute. Eventually, her organization would release a new app called Up and Go, which allowed consumers to book house cleaning services and which channeled 95% of the money directly to the workers who also owned the businesses. That evening, with the app more than a year away from release, Yora had a long way to go to make progress against a statistic that appalled her. The news put out by the charity Oxfam that just 62 billionaires possessed as much wealth as the bottom half of humanity, 3.6 billion people, down from 300 billionaires a few years ago. In fact, it was 9 billionaires, not 62, as Oxfam would later say when better data came in. And the following year, the number of billionaires it took to account for half the world's resources dropped from 9 to 8. 6 of those 8 made their money in the supposedly equalizing field of technology. Gates, Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Larry Ellison of Oracle, Carlos Slim of Telmex and other Mexican businesses, and Michael Bloomberg, the purveyor of computer terminals. Another, Amancio Ortega, who built the retailer Zara, was famous for applying advanced technology to manufacturing and for automating his factories. The final member of the Gang of Eight, Warren Buffett, was a major shareholder in Apple and IBM. Chapter 4. The Critic and the Thought Leader. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on not understanding it. Upton Sinclair. In October 2011, in the sleepy village of Camden, Maine, Amy Cuddy prepared to give her first proper talk outside academia. Cuddy was a social psychologist at Harvard Business School who had spent more than a decade publishing papers on the workings of prejudice, discrimination, and systems of power. She had written of how the sexism that women face is a strange amalgam of the envy men feel toward career women and the pity they feel for women who don't work. She had written of how socialized obedience and conformity played into the decisions of both the 9/11 hijackers and the American guards at Abu Ghraib who tortured their prisoners. She had written of how white people taking computerized implicit bias tests became more prejudiced when informed that the test's purpose was to measure racism. She had written of how, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, people more easily perceived anguish, mourning, remorse, and other uniquely human emotions in people of the same race as them than in people of other hues. She had written of the model minority stereotype that shadows so many Asian Americans. That autumn, she was continuing to work with a team on a long-term project to study how men's hegemony, that most global of phenomena, adapts to local conditions so as to enroot itself. In America, where being independent and self-oriented are the leading cultural ideals, she and her colleagues wrote, the society tends to cast men as independent and self-oriented. In South Korea, where being interdependent and others-oriented are more prized, the society